and wasted passions. All these women, among whom she had always lived and who made up the human world to her, now appeared to her as both pitiable and boring. But she, who served great powers, she, the priestess of grim night, was free of that pettiness. She did not have to care about the grinding meanness of their common life. The days whose one delight was likely to be getting a bigger slop of lamb fat over your lentils than your neighbor got. She was free of the days altogether. Underground, there were no days. There was always and only night. And in that unending night, the prisoner, the dark man, practicer of dark arts, bound in iron and locked in stone, waiting for her to come, or not to come, to bring him water and bread and life, or a knife and a butcher's bowl and death, just as the whim took her. She had told no one but Kossil about the man, and Kossil had not told anyone else. He had been in the painted room 3 nights and days now, and still she had not asked Arha about him. Perhaps she assumed that he was dead, and that Arha had had Manon carry the body to the room of bones. It was not like Kossil to take anything for granted, but Arha told herself that there was nothing strange about Kossil's silence. Kossil wanted everything kept secret, and hated to have to ask questions. And besides, Arha had told her not to meddle in her business. Kossil was simply obeying. However, if the man was supposed to be dead, Arha could not ask for food for him. So aside from stealing some apples and dried onions from the cellars of the big house, she did without food. She had her morning and evening meals sent to the small house, pretending she wished to eat alone, and each night took the food down to the painted room in the labyrinth, all but the soups. She was used to fasting for a day on up to 4 days at a time, and thought nothing about it. The fellow in the labyrinth ate up her meager portions of bread and cheese and beans, as a toad eats a fly. Snap! It's gone. Clearly he could have done so 5 or 6 times over. But he thanked her soberly, as if he were her guest and she his hostess, at a table such as she had heard of in tales of feasts at the palace of the God-King, all set with roast meats and buttered loaves and wine in crystal. He was very strange. "What is it like in the inner lands?" She had brought down a little cross-leg folding stool of ivory, so that she would not have to stand while she questioned him, and yet would not have to sit down on the floor on his level. "Well, there are many islands. 40 times, they say, in the archipelago alone. And then there are the reaches. Well, no man has ever sailed all the reaches, nor counted all the lands. And each is different from the others. But the fairest of them all, maybe, is Havnar, the great land at the center of the world. In the heart of Havnar, on a broad bay full of ships, is the city Havnar. The towers of the city are built of white marble. The house of every prince and merchant has a tower, so they rise up one above the other. The roofs of the houses are red tile, and all the bridges over the canals are covered in mosaic work, red and blue and green. And the flags of the princes are all colors, flying from the white towers. On the highest of all the towers, the sword of Aerith Akbi is set, like a pinnacle, skyward. When the sun rises on Havnar, it flashes first on that blade, and makes it bright. And when it sets, the sword is golden still above the evening, for a while.
Who was Aerith Akbi?
she said, sly. He looked up at her. He said nothing, but he grinned a little. Then, as if on second thoughts, he said, "It's true you would know little of him here. Nothing beyond his coming to the Kargish lands, perhaps. And how much of that tale do you know?"
"That he lost his sorcerer's staff and his amulet and his power,
like you," she answered. "He escaped from the high priest and fled to the west, and dragons killed him. But if he'd come here to the tombs, there had been no need of dragons."
"True enough," said her prisoner.
She wanted no more talk of Aerith Akby, sensing a danger in the subject.
"He was a dragon lord, they say, and you say you're one. Tell me, what is a dragon lord?"
Her tone was always jeering. His answers, direct and plain, as if he took her questions in good faith.
"One whom the dragons will speak with," he said. "That is a dragon lord, or at least that is the center of the matter. It's not a trick of mastering the dragons, as most people think. Dragons have no masters. The question is always the same with a dragon. Will he talk with you, or will he eat you? If you can count upon his doing the former and not doing the latter, why then, you're a dragon lord."
"Dragons can speak?"
"Oh, surely. In the eldest tongue, the language we men learn so hard and use so brokenly to make our spells of magic and of patterning, no man knows all that language, or a tenth of it. He has not time to learn it. But dragons live 1,000 years. They are worth talking to, as you might guess."
"Are there dragons here in Atuan?"
"Well, not for many centuries, I think. Nor in Karego-At. But in your northernmost island, Hur-at-Hur, they say there are still large dragons in the mountains. In the inner lands they all keep now to the farthest west, the remote west reach, islands where no men live and few men come. If they grow hungry, they raid the lands to their east, but that is seldom. I have seen the island where they come